Well, thank you very much, and it's great to be here with you all, especially discussing this topic. I was in town or yesterday. I was south of here speaking at Sarah Anderson's church, Fort Valley, Georgia. So this worked out very well. I'm going to, and how much time do I have, Phil? The schedule said 2 to 3, I thought, which sounded like an awful lot of time.
You know, if you want to go until 2:30, is that okay?
Okay. I have a lot of content, but I'll just stop at 2:30, wherever I am.
And then we can have Q&A.
Sure. Anyway, I am addressing you about Christianity as a social and political witness. And first of all, to give you some background about IRD and its origins, which obviously relate very tightly to the political witness of Christianity, in that IRD was a direct response to some of the worst and most corrupt aspects of the political witness of Christianity, in that by the late 1970s, much of the mainline Protestant world, still influential 40 years ago, was enthralled by liberation theology and was literally supporting, in some cases, armed Marxist revolution and regimes around the world, which, of course, were actively persecuting the Christian church and other persons of conscience, with the idea that the equality that those regimes and movements would bring would more than compensate for the loss of human rights. And the founders of the IRD, Protestant and Evangelical and Catholic, responded that the church should not of itself be primarily a political instrument, but when it does speak politically, it should speak premised on the dignity of each individual and should be decidedly partial towards political systems that protect that human dignity and protect human rights, and that at that point in history, democracy certainly was more protective of human dignity and human rights than were the authoritarian and totalitarian alternatives. And so Richard Neuhaus, one of our founders, crafted a founding document called Christianity and Democracy, making those very points, in which I commend to you, easily findable online. In terms of what have been the two major models of Christian political witness for Protestantism in America over the last century, there is that to which IRD was responding, or at least we were responding to a corrupted latter version of it, which was the social gospel presentation of mainline Protestantism that emerged in the late 19th century and early 20th century, with a lot of nobility behind it. If you read the Social Creed ratified by the Federal Council of Churches in 1908, which they borrowed word for word from the Northern Methodist Church's General Conference earlier that year, it's mostly an articulation of labor rights and opposition to child labor, and having a 6-day work week, proposals that none of us would find controversial. And it certainly was an effort to enflesh Christian ideas about equality and human dignity. Of course, that social gospel, where it erred as it grew across the decades, was the idea that society could potentially be perfected through politics and through legislation and through the right political attitudes. And certainly there is a direct line between the near utopianism of that social gospel early in the 20th century and the embrace of liberation theology and even Marxism by later in the 20th century. And so that's one particular tradition for Protestantism over the last century, one that would not be, I think, commendable to our efforts here, obviously. And in fact, some of us became involved in the renewal of our church in direct response to that corrupted vision of Christian political witness. And then there's another articulation of Christian political witness, more recent, dating back about 45 years, coming from the right side of the spectrum, and arguably most influentially articulated by Francis Schaeffer, the great Reformed thinker, founder of Labri, who wrote a Christian manifesto, among other books about what he hoped would be the redemption of Western civilization and a return to its Christian roots. And I can recall, as a very young man in college, I actually subscribed to Jerry Falwell's magazine called The Fundamentalist. Anyone else remember that magazine from the early 1980s? Quite bold in their self-proclaimed title. But as a reward for subscribing to that magazine, they would send you Francis Schaeffer's A Christian Manifesto. So I was introduced to his works. And in fact, Jerry Falwell, one of the founders of the modern religious right, I really saw Schaeffer as the chief theorist for what he had in mind. And essentially, Schaeffer was translating his version of a Calvinist perspective on the ideal society and relating it to American democracy as conceived by the founders, et cetera, et cetera. And so at least there was a theory behind it. I think that much of that theory has been neglected or forgotten over the last 40 years. It's very hard to find anyone under the age of 50 who even remembers much less knows anything about Francis Schaeffer. And if you were to inquire who are the major political theorists or thinkers of the right side of Christian political activism today, it would be very hard to conceive who those thinkers are. It's very heavy on the activism and not so heavy on the thinking. So perhaps that's another lesson for us as we try to put together our own Christian political witness, that we want to be to have a healthy balance between the activism and the thinking. You might recall that, I believe it was 2 years ago, but I've lost track of time, we decided as the Common Ground Christian Network that in our social witness, our chief focus areas would be the protection of the sanctity of all human life, the protection of traditional natural marriage and family, and protection of religious liberty. And those issues obviously are not only very timely, because they are all under threat in current American politics and in current Western society, but also they all are deeply rooted in traditional Christian social teaching, I believe. But I wanted to share with you, over the next 35 minutes anyway, what are some principles behind traditional Christian social teaching that should guide us in the future, not wanting to repeat the mistakes of others and just being haphazard and ad hoc in our approach, but wanting to connect to the universal and historic church. And so the insights I'm going to share with you come from two individuals, one Roman Catholic and the other Presbyterian, the first of whom is, the Catholics would say Joseph Cardinal Hofner. Cardinal Hofner was the Archbishop of Cologne for 20 years. He died in the late 1980s and was closely associated with John Paul II. And he wrote a book called simply Christian Social Teaching that lays it all out. And thankfully, it was translated into English about 20 years ago, and it was transmitted to me by a Catholic friend very helpfully. The other thinker I'm going to quote is still very much alive and is a young rising star, I think, named Daniel Strand at Arizona State University, who's a contributing editor to IRD's new journal called Providence, and has been commissioned by us to write essentially a Protestant or evangelical equivalent of that book by Cardinal Hofner on Christian political thought and describing the historic Christian understanding of God's purposes for government and politics. So I'm going to start off quoting from Cardinal Hofner, if I'm pronouncing his German name correctly, and then I'll move on to Daniel Strand. The first quote I'll share from the Cardinal is this, very early in his work. He says, as its goal, Christian social teaching has in mind a system of order based, as it must be, on truth, tempered by justice, motivated by mutual love, and holding fast to the practice of freedom. So I thought that was a very nice articulation. He goes on to make clear that the underlying purpose of government and political order is love. And he says, I'm quoting him, "Love, not fear, must dominate the relationships between individuals and between nations. It is principally characteristic of love that it draws men together in all sorts of ways, sincerely united in the bonds of mind and matter. And this is a union from which countless blessings can flow. It teaches us to distinguish between error, which always merits repudiation, and the person in error, who never loses the dignity of being a person, even when he is flawed by false or inadequate religious notions." So an important lesson for us today in our own time, and certainly for in all times. The cardinal emphasizes the importance of both natural law and eternal law in undergirding our understanding of human government and human politics. And he says this, and this is a lot of rich content, so I hope you'll be patient, but I think all of you are mature enough to absorb and enjoy it and really profit from it. But he says, natural law is part of the natural moral law is ultimately grounded in the eternal law of the Creator and is bonding in conscience. It is therefore false to oppose morals as inner morality to law as outer reality. However, law in no way encompasses all moral realms, such as piety or chastity or love of self or love of neighbor. Human law, as Thomas Aquinas teaches, appeals to the multitude, which for the most part is not exactly perfect in virtue. Human law does not therefore forbid all vices, but only the more grievous ones, which the majority of people are capable of avoiding, especially those crimes without the prohibition of which human society cannot be maintained. Thus, human law prohibits murder, theft, and the like. Human law also generally contents itself with the external fulfillment of prescriptions without asking about the inner attitudes of the person. Penal law, however, cannot exclude the investigation into motive and guilt, so that the assertions that judicial decisions should not in principle take ethical evaluations as a basis is deplorably false, for the inner binding character of law rests precisely on its agreement with the moral law. So that's a lot to absorb, but some important points in there. The cardinal also emphasizes that there's primary and secondary natural law, and this is a concept I need to investigate more myself, but I'll just allude to it briefly. He says, the church fathers, such as Irenaeus, distinguish early between the primary natural law, which is valid independently of the fall of man, and the secondary natural law, which presupposes the state of fallen nature. Whereas the right to life pertains to the primary natural law, the institution of private property belongs to the secondary natural law. So an interesting distinguishing there. The cardinal makes the point that marriage and the human family pre-exist human government, which is a very important point as we defend both. And he says this, in the face of all attempts to relativize marriage and entrust it to caprice, the Christian faith holds fast to the essential form of this institution. No human law can take away the original natural right of a man to marry or in any way impose limits of the principal purpose of marriage ordained by God's authority from the beginning. Marriage is older than the state, one therefore which must have its own rights and duties which depend not at all upon the state. And he also stresses, of course, that family is the central cell of all human societies, saying, according to the Christian understanding, the family is rather the cell of society in a biological and moral respect. In the family, the nation finds the natural, fruitful fruit for its greatness and power, for biologically it is the primordial cell and the mother cell of society. For this reason, a nation in which marriage and family decay is sooner or later doomed to perish. The family is rightly called a cell of society in a moral respect also. When the family is no longer the foundation of society, the first place of education and culture, depersonalization and loss of individuality is the inevitable result. Man acquires those social virtues without which a society cannot exist in the family: love of neighbor, consideration of others, compatibility, justice, solidarity, piety, and the ability to obey and to command. The cardinal makes the point that government is not responsible for all human needs. There again, an important point that as we look at Christian political witness today, where many, not just on the left, but increasingly on the right, have a very expansive view of government's central duties. The cardinal said, Christian social teaching sets out from the following principles in the critical evaluation of the system of social security. It is a man's right and duty to be primarily responsible for his own upkeep and that of his family. The smallest community which should bestow on man a sense of social secureness is the family. Even if the family has lost many functions in our current age so that it's no longer able to guarantee the whole of social security, the family household still offers a high measure of security. Of great importance for social security, particularly for the self-employed, are self-help measures by cooperatives which offer a formation in solidarity, thinking in action, and achieve with united forces things that the individual is unable to accomplish. Here again, referring to civil society as opposed to government. And he says, conditions in the industrial society entail the fact that social security can no longer be guaranteed entirely by individuals, families, and cooperatives alone without the assistance of nationwide institutions. So he admits the government does play a role, but not the central role. The Cardinal also emphasizes that in the Christian pursuit of a just society, there must be a love of that society and a love of the nation. And he says this, and he's referring to the Second Vatican Council, which summons us to a generous and loyal devotion to, being a German, he calls it, to our fatherland. Love of fatherland is not a mere feeling, even less chauvinism. It is more than obedience and loyalty. It's a lively participation in the weal and woe of the people and is embedded in love for all peoples, which means being open to the whole human family without any narrowing of mind. So I think he's making the point that we're called to love and serve all humanity as Christians, but that love has no center if we don't begin with a love with those to whom we're most proximate, our own family, our own neighbors, friends, our own society, our own nation. The Cardinal makes the point that for there to be political justice, there must be a functioning state, and that state authority is central to the pursuit of a just society. He says, according to the Christian understanding, government authority accompanies the state by nature, even against the will of the citizens. So there's always a nature of coercion. Without a centralized state authority ordering things towards the common good, the realization of the end of the state is impossible, since individuals always pursue their own private advantage, which often stands in contradiction to the common good. So he says the state or government is coercive by definition, but it's certainly not unlimited in its authority and power. He says, since the state is the highest guardian of the common good, its authority must be centralized, comprehensive, sovereign, and coercive. But it's, of course, contradictory to Christian thought to see in the state a power that is fully unlimited, both intrinsically and extrinsically, and even illimitable. According to the Christian understanding, there is, outside hell, no totally closed society. The state may not fall prey to that intolerant exclusivity leading to terror and war, which knows neither God nor neighbor nor human dignity. Of course, the Cardinal was himself a survivor who had lived through the Third Reich, so he knew the terror of a totalitarian society without limits. The Cardinal makes a point that Christianity is not historically tied to any particular form of government. He says that it follows from the foregoing considerations that the Christian doctrine of the state is not tied to any form of government. Of course, every form of government stands under the law of the common good. Which form of government merits preference at a given time and under given conditions is to a large extent historically conditioned. Democracy seems to correspond best to the awareness of life and way of thinking of modern man, although a life worthy of man is also possible under other forms of government, for example, a monarchy. It would, however, be disastrous to distort the democratic principle as a utopian pseudo-religious messianism instead of applying it in an objective, sober manner. So yes, a preference for democracy, but most Christians in most times and places have not lived under democracy. He outlines some of the particular duties of the state. He says the field of the governmental authority's duties in legislation, administration, and dispensation of justice is defined by the end of the state, which consists of the creation of the presuppositions for a prosperous development of the individual, smaller social circles, and society as a whole. The following belong to the essential task of the governmental authority: external defense, and in general, an honest and just foreign policy; the construction and preservation of a legal system, which must take shape in the state constitution, in the economic constitution, in private law, in penal law, and so on; a just administration and dispensation of justice, as well as care for the public welfare. And then he talks about government and lethal force, which is an issue in contention today. And he says, it is not without a purpose that the ruler carries the sword. He is God's servant to inflict his avenging wrath upon the wrongdoer, as St. Paul references in Romans 13:4. The church has indeed fought against blood vengeance, but nevertheless recognized the governmental authority's right of the sword. He quotes Pope Innocent, who prescribed this declaration to the Waldensians. We declare that the governmental authority can impose the death penalty without serious sin, presupposing this penalty is imposed not out of hate, but on the basis of judgment, not arbitrarily, but after mature reflection. Then he quotes Pope Pius in the 1950s, who declared that it is reserved to the public authority to deprive the condemned of their lives as reparation for their crimes after they have already forfeited their right to life through their crimes. And the cardinal goes on to say, the state's right of the sword is a forceful recognition of the inviolability of the highest human goods, especially of human life. The sanctity of the divine order is proved mighty even in the age by the death penalty. The death penalty is an act of self-defense on the part of the state. Its justification is ultimately grounded in the fact that the common good cannot be preserved in any other way. But he also says the right of the state to impose the death penalty does not imply that the state is not allowed to renounce the exercise of this right. So obviously Catholic teaching has more recently emphasized that point. So an important distinction. He talks about the government's responsibility to defend against aggression. He says there are goods which the divine order of peace absolutely obligates one to respect and to guarantee. Goods such that an offense against them by an aggressor state is an attack on the majesty of God. These goods are of such importance for human social life that their defense against unjust attack is without doubt fully justified. It is not a question here of just any kind of goods, such as territorial claims, but of the highest goods of a nation's life, the right to life, to justice, to freedom of conscience, and of religion. He talks about the limits of a government and the need for toleration in a just society. He says, divine and natural law set firm limits to governmental authority. Above all, the personal dignity of man and the essential order of marriage and the family are inviolable. In most states, the limits of governmental authority are more closely defined through the Constitution, which guarantees, for example, the freedom of conscience and the freedom of speech, the freedom of association, the freedom to choose a profession and a place of work, and the protection of private property. Since people of different religions and philosophies of life live together in modern society, particular importance attaches to the problem of toleration, not only in religion, but also in education, training, science, and other realms of cultural life. Setting out from the principle that no one should be forced to sacrifice his or her principles, Christian social teaching advocates respect for toleration in both the public and in the social realms. And then moving towards the end, he warns against the inevitable flaws of government and says, every government will nevertheless bear within itself the insufficiency of everything earthly and created. In other words, it's fallen like the rest of humanity. With greater or less justification, one will find one thing or another to criticize in all laws and in all governmental measures. More alarming is the fact that states and governments exhibit not only one defect or another, as experience teaches, but can degenerate altogether into criminal tyrannies, against which we must always be on guard. And then finally, he makes a point about subsidiarity, which is an important Catholic teaching that we Protestants should perhaps appreciate more about. He says, just as it is gravely wrong to take from individuals what they can accomplish by their own initiative and industry and give it to the community, so it's also an injustice and at the same time a grave evil and disturbance of right order to assign to a greater and higher association what lesser and subordinate organizations can do. For every social activity ought of its very nature to furnish help to the members of the body social and never destroy and absorb them. Therefore, those in power should be sure that the more perfectly a graduated order is kept among the various associations in observance of the principle of subsidiarity, the stronger social authority and effectiveness will be, the happier and more prosperous the condition of the state. So in other words, if you can do it locally in your neighborhood, it shouldn't be the federal government that's doing it. Let those who are at the closest to the issue handle it when at all possible. So those are the words from the Roman Catholic Cardinal in his book on Christian social teaching. I'll now share from the Presbyterian thinker, Daniel Strand, who I don't think contradicts any of his insights, but maybe adds a little bit to it and a little bit more of a Protestant flavor in this forthcoming book that he's writing for us. But he makes a very important point that government, of course, is not a savior to us. Should be an obvious point, but a point often missing in a lot of contemporary Christian political witness. Daniel says, government does not save, and yet many today, though they wouldn't admit, essentially see government's capacities and abilities as quasi-salvific. Investing our politics with such redemptive power is dangerous because there is no danger greater in the political community than that which we ascribe to politics, the ability to regenerate individuals and society. Daniel makes a point that for government, security is its primary vocation. He says national security and national interest in this context have an important role as mediators of divine common grace. Protecting and persevering our society and the nation-state system is an important part of government's divine vocation. National interest and security, though, must be held to the bar of God's law and rule and not become elevated above it. That will place limits on what the government should do to ensure our security and advance our national interests. Security at any cost and promotion of natural interest as an end in itself would be a return to paganism. So, an important point. He declares, which should be obvious, but should nonetheless be said, Jesus is different from government. The pattern of Jesus is obviously something quite different from the duties of the state and its security responsibilities especially. Jesus calls us to follow in his way, to lay down our lives for our neighbors. But the witness of government is God's will that society and the goods therein be preserved to save us from chaos and anarchy, not to redeem us and raise us from the dead, which obviously is Jesus' unique calling. Daniel makes the point that government is, of course, under divine authority. He says the most important political task of the church is not to be political in the sense engaging in local or national politics. It is to remind the government that it's under the authority of another, that the rulers of this age are held to account and will be held to account to the law of God. It is to remind governments that their judgments are imperfect at best and that their laws and activities are not the final word for human life. The government now punishes, but this is not what God has planned for us in the new heavens and in the new earth. It does not make those activities wrong, but it brings to our awareness the fragility and finite nature of our own discernment and enactment of human justice and punishment. He makes the point that God and not the state ultimately right all injustice in the end, saying that Jesus will come again to bring his rule to completion through the judgment and the establishment of his kingdom for eternity. He will judge all the nations. All wrong shall be righted. All persons of all nations shall worship and enjoy a level of fellowship together unimpeded by human weakness and sin. That's all possible to his authority and power, not to any political order of our own making. Daniel emphasizes the fidelity, that fidelity to God makes us better citizens in this world and our own societies. He says, as Christians, we now live in between the ascension and consummation of Jesus' kingly rule. King Jesus rules his own people now in a special way, even as he rules all the nations in another way. Christians are first and foremost members of his kingdom and rule. They are strangers and aliens, wherever they find themselves, because they are citizens of heaven. Some would have us thinking this citizenship places us at odds with our government and society, but this is simplistic and wrong. Our heavenly citizenship and loyalty to Jesus, above all, drive us to a deeper sense of responsibility, commitment, and suffering on behalf of our country and society, even as it places a definite limit on the extent of our loyalty. Daniel makes a point that government is an aspect of divine grace. He says God has provided a provisional regime of judgment to preserve peace, justice, and order until the return of Christ. Protestants have referred to political rule as a part of God's common grace. This grace is distinct from inward regenerating grace that brings about our conversion and regeneration. It is rather external and deals with the order of human communities, not the human heart. Government is given as a common grace by God, irregardless of merit. Interesting point. A ruler or government may be wicked or good, but some form of government will always persist because God has willed it so. Daniel makes the point that government must be secular. So listen closely to this particular point. For Christians, all government must be secular government. Secular government, that is, government of this age, in distinction from the contemporary usage which stresses government indifferent or hostile towards religion. This form of government will pass away in the age when the king returns. Like a babysitter, government keeps the house in order, but when the parents return, the babysitter's job is done. The judgments of governments and courts of law are not divine. The application of laws is imperfect and sometimes unjust. Innocent people shall be unjustly punished. But as the scriptures make clear, all government is accountable to God. God establishes rulers and governments, and he removes them. Why some governments persist and others do not is not given to human hearts in a clear fashion, but we can be sure that it is God's providence always at work. Daniel warns us that government cannot perfect society. He says political authorities ought and in fact cannot bring about the transformation of the world or the perfection of any society. Sin runs through every human heart, something which laws cannot remedy. Human beings and society are not perfectible, and therefore we ought not to try to perfect them through law. The social gospel and liberal Protestantism generally make the mistake of turning the kingdom of God into a social project. But the kingdom of God will not come with our careful observation or our human efforts. That does not mean we ought not pursue justice and peace, but only that our goal is always more modest and more limited. And then finally, he makes a little bit of a distinction between the Protestant understanding of government's calling and the Catholic one. He said that St. Augustine believed politics was a remedy for sin that did not exist before the fall of man and will not exist after we are redeemed. Catholics, in turn, see political community as natural and not merely a check on sin. Thomas Aquinas argued that before the fall, there was some sort of ordered political community. So interesting, I need to learn more about those distinctions between Aquinas and Augustine and between Protestants and Catholics on that point. Going on towards Daniel's conclusion regarding government's central purpose, the purpose of government is to govern, obviously. This is a limited activity. The picture that emerges from both scripture and history on the purpose of government within Christian thought and practice is that of making and enforcing law as a means to ensure a just and peaceful society. The laws and not the government itself are what mediates and bears witness to God's commands. Interesting. God ordains rulers. There is a consistent thread that runs through the entirety of scripture with regards to political rule. It may be summarized as follows. Rulers are called to fulfill their duty by upholding God's justice and peace, whether or not they are completely aware of who God is or what he requires. So the ruler himself need not be himself a pious person, but nonetheless is still an instrument of the divine will, if he is doing justice. God places rulers into positions of power, and he expects them to act according to a set of standards that are determined by God. When they do not fulfill their duty, often God punishes them or removes them. Upholding God's justice and peace does not mean establishing the nations as holy entities, but enacting God's just judgment against injustice, and thereby establishing a relative or an approximate peace. Daniel makes the point that a government's legitimacy is based on its actions and not its form. The authority of government is derived from its activity and not its form. Governments are authorized by God to perform the action of enacting justice and observing the limits of this authority. Perhaps the American Republican form of government is the best form of government, but popular sovereignty and elections are not how governments derive their authority. Governments are given the responsibility of performing the action of judgment upon wickedness and thereby acting as a means of God's vindication against wrongdoing. Providing for the welfare of the people through various governmental programs, therefore, lies outside of what is strictly required of governments. So, in other words, Daniel is suggesting government does not necessarily ordain the welfare state. He says, advocates of social justice assume that to uphold the cause of the poor means offering welfare programs, but the idea that the government or ruler is required to provide for the welfare of its subjects or citizens becomes possible only with the advent of the modern welfare state. In order to vindicate and uphold the cause of the poor and oppressed, a government need not establish a modern welfare state, but execute judgment against those sources of oppression and injustice in order to rectify the injustice. The ubiquity of rights talk today has created the illusion that the government is required to do all sorts of activities for its citizens because it's right, not because it's ordained to do so. And then he concludes, once again stressing the basic duty of government, the most basic activity of enacting justice and preserving peace for those under the rule is the punishment of wrongdoing within the political community and the defense of the community against foreign threat. So here again he's quoting the early church father Irenaeus, who said, "So that under the fear of human rule, men may not eat each other up like fishes, but that by establishment of laws they may keep down an excess of wickedness among the nations." So in essence, not creating the kingdom of God through politics, but limiting the worst forms of evil. And Daniel goes on finally to say, does this understanding mean necessarily a minimal libertarian state? No, but it does sharpen our sense of what government's mandate from God is. We surely want all to have health insurance or well-paying jobs, but this is not the purpose of government proper, though governments may with good reason offer health insurance or jobs training programs. So that's just a summary of what Daniel Strand says in his forthcoming book for the IRD on God's purposes for government. So hopefully you'll be reading that book sometime next year. So in concluding my sharing these thoughts with you from a Presbyterian friend and the late Roman Catholic Archbishop of Cologne, I would say that lessons for us should be chiefly, let's not forget the core historic purposes of government. Let's remember the duties and limits of politics, and let's recall what government is called to do and what it's not called to do. And let's keep in mind, as we've already resolved, that our special vocation in this group and in this time and place, in this time in history and in this society, includes a special focus on the protection of all human life, from womb to the very end, protection of marriage, natural marriage and family, and of religious liberty, all of which are and have been central to historic Christian teaching. And we must also not replicate the mistakes of so much of Christian social witness over the last century in terms of exaggerating our own authority to speak as ecclesial bodies or as Christian individuals. When we do speak, we should speak in language that is as timeless as possible and not as bound to our current situation, our current politics, our current fads and interests, so that if our statements are read 500 years from now, they will be as timely and relevant as they are today if we are reading St. Augustine or Thomas Aquinas or the early church fathers on these issues. It's a high bar to reach, but one that we should certainly aim for. So that's the conclusion of my review of Christian social teaching as historically understood by at least two teachers, if you have 4 or 5 minutes of questions or comments.